Hello and welcome to the first ever Aldi podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Aldi. In the November issue of The Aldi, we've got a great double header on Pete and Dud, the great Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, a piece by Elizabeth Luard, who knew Peter Cook and Dudley Moore well, and William Cook, who is the biographer of both of them. Elizabeth, if we could start with your piece. You found this extraordinary stash of photos that you'd had for decades. If you could tell us the story.
Well, I was moving from my house in Wales, and my daughter was rooting around in the garage, and she came in with this box, tattered box, full of all the records from the establishment, which was the Satire Club in central London, in Soho, that was started by Peter Cook and my husband Nicholas Luard.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much before I met Nicholas, so it was pretty exciting at that time, because I was working at Private Eye. As a stamp licker, let's not big ourselves up on that, nothing literary.
And we've all heard of the establishment, but can you tell us a bit about how it came together in the first place, the establishment?
Well, I think it really rose from Nicholas's friendship with Peter at Cambridge, and so there was a Footlights connection there. And there were a lot of people who were interested in upsetting the political apple cart. So it grew out of that. It was very subversive, and it was a genuine young man's attempt to break a mould at a time when the political elite was, well, not so unlike now, i.e. self-perpetuating oligarchy.
Right. And looking at the wonderful pictures you found, what's striking is A, how young everyone is, but also B, this extraordinary array of talent, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, the two Johns, Bird and Fortune. It looks like a golden age in retrospect. Did it seem like one at the time?
It didn't look like an age of anything, because we were all so young. But it did look very exciting. But since we were in the middle of it, it was like sort of at the centre of a storm. And we all knew that things were changing. We didn't know whether we could push them in the direction we wanted them to go. I say we, but quite honestly, the women were much more supporting of the men. There are some women in there, but not that many.
Because your job, if you can explain, was acting, working for Private Eye, is that right?
Yes, stamp picking, coffee making, taking the mag down to the printers, flogging it round Cambridge Circus with a figure called Irwin Corey, who used to, his method of selling was to rush out in the middle of the traffic, roll his trouser leg up to his bony knee, and wave it around as if he was a sort of one-legged man, at which point cars would stop and I was supposed to rush forward and thrust a copy of Private Eye through the window.
And it is extraordinary. I think they both began in 1961, is that right? Private Eye and the establishment.
They began more or less at the same time and they didn't trust one another a bit.
Right. Because they, although largely Oxbridge graduates, they were slightly different sorts of people, is that right to say?
I think that the establishment was highly political, whereas the Eye at that point, as they saw it, would be a kind of school mag. You know, it wasn't pioneering in the way that the establishment was going to be.
And they're both, and broadly speaking, satirical. But I've just interviewed Richard Ingrams for his 80th birthday. I should have said that Peter Cook would have turned 80 on November the 17th. That's why it's in the November issue. And when I interviewed Richard Ingrams a couple of weeks ago, he said we didn't call it satire at the time. That's what it was called afterwards. Were you aware that you were at the beginning of something new, and when did you begin to realise it was so-called satire?
Well, I wouldn't entirely agree with Richard, because the strapline was London's first satirical nightclub.
Really?
So satire was right in there at the beginning.
Right. Okay, move on to William Cook, who is the biographer of both Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. He's written the book One Leg Too Few, The Adventures of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And he's got an extremely moving story in the November Aldi about Dudley Moore's last years escaping a stormy marriage in the west coast of America to move to suburban New Jersey to move in with a couple of distinguished classical musicians. Can you tell us the story and how you came to know these musicians?
Yes, the musicians are Rena Fruchter and Brian Dallow, and they've become two of my best friends. I met them about 15 years ago. Lynn Cook, Peter's third and final wife, who sadly just passed away at the end of last year, she had asked me to compile a kind of anthology of Peter Cook's work. And obviously a lot of this work, was a lot of this writing, a lot of these sketches were done with Dudley.
Right.
And Dudley then was very, very ill. He was dying of a horrible disease called supraprogressive nuclear palsy, I think I pronounced that right, which is a very aggressive form of Parkinson's. And I discovered that the people who were looking after his affairs, rather than being some hotshot New York or Los Angeles showbiz agent, which is what I assumed, was actually this very nice, charming, homely, very intelligent, very very homely couple called Rena and Brian. So to use any of Dudley's stuff, I had to get in touch with Rena. Sadly, during the course of putting this first book together, the book was called Tragically I Was an Only Twin, which was the abortive title of Peter's autobiography. He was great at coming up with titles, not quite so good at actually getting round to writing the book. Dudley died, and so then I was dealing with Rena and Brian full time. And really the story of their relationship with him is a remarkable one, and I got a bit sidetracked actually. I sort of thought this story is almost more interesting than the one I'm supposed to be writing.
Right.
Basically, he'd been living the LA dream, Dudley, having an absolutely miserable time. He was on his fourth marriage. Each marriage seemed to be worse.
It was late 90s, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Each marriage was worse than the one before. There were, you know, all sorts of fast living involved, and it was making him utterly miserable. And the fourth marriage was very destructive to a woman who was half his age, and he was very, very unhappy. And he was also becoming ill. He then wanted to try and revive his classical musical career. And Rena Fruchter, was working as a music critic at that time for the Boston Globe, various other people. And she came along to see him give a performance, and she thought it was really remarkable. Now, the thing that people often forget about Dudley is that he'd started off as a musician, a proper classical musician. He was a musical prodigy. He was an absolute genius. And he got an organ scholarship to Oxford, having started out on a council estate in Dagenham, where nobody, I think, that he knew was got much beyond grade one on the piano. And he'd been working as a jazz musician when the establishment kicked off, and when he met Peter, and he'd been a kind of victim of this satirical success that Elizabeth talks about. You know, he'd been taken up with Peter, he'd been an incredible foil for Peter. They'd gone on from the Establishment Club to the West End to Broadway to Hollywood. And then suddenly he turned around and found he was in his 50s and, you know, had hardly done the thing that he was really talented at and really good at, rather than very good at, for most of his life. And he was trying to start again.
He hadn't recorded any classical music records or anything like that?
He'd done a few things, but I mean, it was sort of charity things and benefit things and stuff like that. And he really wanted to get back to doing it seriously. Now, Rena was a former child prodigy at the piano herself, never done any comedy. It was all serious, straight classical music. And she said, I'll help you. She was running a remarkable charity with her husband, Brian, who's English, funnily enough, and got a very similar background to Dudley's in a lot of ways, except he hadn't gone down the comedy route. He just stuck to the classical music. And Dudley, when he heard about this charity, it's called Music for All Seasons. They take music into prisons and hospitals and places where people are confined and can't get to have much access to classical music. Dudley loved the sound of this, and he said, I'll do a benefit concert for you. Rena said, well, what would you like to do? He said, Grieg's Piano Concerto. So apparently, is one of the most fiendish pieces of music a pianist can attempt. She said, okay, if you fancy that, I'll try and help you do it. Where would you like to do it? He said, Carnegie Hall. So, you know, this charity was on quite a low level at that time, quite compact. So they went ahead and booked Carnegie Hall. Rena came out to Los Angeles, work through the concert with him. Anyway, they put the concert on. It was a great success.
What date was this, do you know?
This is about, I think, about 1997, 96, right. Something like that. It was a great success. It raised a lot of money for the this wonderful charity. It was also great for Dudley. It's exactly what he wanted to be doing. And so then they kind of set off around the world. You know, they did all sorts of other piano concertos. Rena was sort of helping him. Sometimes she'd be on stage actively helping, other times she'd be behind the scenes. And they went to Australia, and all over the States. They went everywhere, and very successfully. And it was during this time that Dudley started to have problems with his health. And eventually the music wound down. Dudley's home life became no better, probably worse. And in the end, he said, look, can I come and live with you while I try and get to the bottom of all this? And so he did. And when he finally got a diagnosis, sadly, there was no cure. He ended up buying the house next door, which I've been to. I've been to stay with Rena and Brian. And he had all his meals in their house. He got to know the family. He became a kind of uncle, really.
And it's an extraordinary story. Here's the man who was the toast of the 60s in London, then a Hollywood star in the 70s and 80s. It's relatively humble, the house in New Jersey he moved to.
Yeah, it's a comfortable house, but, you know, classical musicians, they're like actors and most journalists, I guess. You know, they have quite a nice time, but they don't earn much money, you know. So it was a house full of books and music, but, you know, a sort of humble place. But you're absolutely right. There was something, to my mind, almost biblical about it. It was almost a kind of prodigal son story. He'd been away to the flesh pots of Los Angeles. He'd become this Hollywood sex thimble. All the wonderful things that we dream of in our idle moments were available to him, and he kind of sampled quite a lot of them. Ended up thoroughly miserable and did, you know, find a kind of peace and happiness there in New Jersey.
Returning to the music.
Yeah, returning to the music. And returning to a kind of simpler life. Getting to know the family, spending a lot of time with them. He'd had two sons during his four marriages. But he wasn't particularly close to them for various reasons. And he really became an uncle to these kids. Funnily enough, Karen, who's one of Rena and Brian's daughters, she qualified as a lawyer, as a family lawyer, at one point when Dudley was living there. And, you know, Dudley went along to the to see her kind of graduate, you know. So it wasn't even just it wasn't a showbiz thing.
And he's buried nearby. He's buried in New Jersey.
He's buried just down the road, yeah. I mean, so he wasn't buried in L.A. He wasn't even buried in Dagenham. He's buried right there, you know. And it's a local restaurant down the road, Charlie Brown's, which is a kind of, you know, slightly upmarket burger place. That was his favourite place, one of his favourite places to eat. He was living a very regular, normal life.
It's an extraordinary story. And Elizabeth, you obviously knew Dudley, and what was he like?
Well, he did play at the establishment. I don't remember him ever being on stage, because Peter would come from finishing the evening performance of Beyond the Fringe, and Dudley would disappear downstairs because there was a jazz club downstairs. And, I mean, it had some remarkable singers, including Annie Ross, singing lyrics by the poet Christopher Loke. It's, you know, and you could hear him, you know, he was a great banger of the piano at that point, and so it was, and people would dance. So it was, one could see, I can understand when you talk, you know, that it was a way of using his talent, and he was very good at it, and very enjoyable. Stanley Myers was, I don't know what he was doing, but Stanley Myers, the composer, he was there as well. I think he was playing something, maybe the piano at the same time. So people would go from one end of the club to the other end, and those evenings down in the club underneath went on forever. I mean, sort of 4 a.m, long after you were supposed to shut the doors.
And as a character, what was he like, Dudley? He comes across extremely funny on telly. I never met him, but what was he like to talk to?
Well, he's quite shy. I mean, to me, I don't know, because I was mostly upstairs watching what was going on stage. And Peter and he... I would see him round at Peter's. Because Peter gave... He was married to his first wife, Wendy, who was a wonderful cook. And we used to cook together sometimes. But the dinners there, Dudley would often be there. But I remember Peter as being the star of that show, you know, and Dudley quite sort of standing back.
And William, you say, actually...
And then a tall girlfriend. Yeah, huge tall girlfriend.
Really?
And so
that
Dudley
was a pattern,
was not tall.
Wasn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
That was very interesting that he had a huge tall girlfriend. He looked and think, right. It's sort of ambitious to get a very tall girlfriend if you're Dudley's...
Confident, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that was... I mean, you know, the women in his life were... It was pretty obvious that it was going to be a problem, you know, because it was... Obviously, were not the relationships were not easy, except at the beginning. You could see that.
And in terms of the double act, William, you talk in your piece. You say without Dudley's warmth and bonhomie, Britain's greatest double act would have been Too Clever by Half. How do you, as somebody who's written a joint biography of them, see that relationship? Peter is often seen as the number one to his number two. Would you agree with that?
Well, the funny thing is that Peter produced very little without Dudley. You know, if you're putting together the complete Peter Cook, an awful lot of it is with Dudley. And although when you're watching these sketches, you think Dudley isn't doing very much, in a way it's quite analogous to jazz. I mean, Dudley is playing the rhythm, and Peter's doing these amazing riffs and these amazing solos. But without that structure, without that basis there, Peter's quite lost. And I think that applied to all sorts of levels in terms of their relationship. You know, when they were on the road, it was kind of the same. When they were on the stage, it was very similar. The writing process, Dudley would learn his lines meticulously and be able to recite them off pat. That would then give Peter the freedom to riff off those lines. But I think that's the case with improvisation and spontaneity. You need a real structure. It doesn't matter what art form you're in. And I think the jazz analogy is a pretty good one. You could say that on the piano, Dudley was the left hand to Peter's right hand. You know, he was keeping the pace, keeping the beat. And he was a kind of sounding ball for Peter. Peter would bounce things off him. And although if you're weighing the words, you know, a sketch might be 80 or 90% Peter, if you took that other 10 or 20% out, the edifice kind of collapses.
And Elizabeth, could you see in the early 60s, when you were seeing this huge gathering of very talented people, that there was something unusual going on between Peter and Dudley at the establishment? Could you see a particular comic relationship building up there?
Well, much more, because we all went to see the Beyond the Fringe and Pieces of Eight, which was another one.
Oh, yes.
Which was Peter's first one, I think. I don't know if Dudley was
Kenneth
in that.
No.
I think he was.
No.
Exactly. So it was much easier to see it on stage at Beyond the Fringe than it ever was in the club.
Right.
Because they were operating in different spheres, really.
Right.
Dudley was the musician, Peter was on stage. And I think it's very interesting what you say about his stage presence, about Dudley's stage presence as really underpinning Peter. Mm-hmm. Because that would explain the anomaly of Peter's relationship with Dudley in later years, which nobody could really... I mean, there was no real truth to be got from that. Peter would say, you know, one thing, maybe, and yes, and he loved Dudley and he didn't see him, and then he didn't see him. And, you know, there was a whole kind of mythology that built up about the relationship between the two of them. So it was that Peter was jealous of Dudley's success, and I mean, but I never heard any evidence of that, not from Peter directly anyway.
I mean, digging back into the stuff in retrospect, having not been there like you, Liz, it's extraordinary what comes across to me is Dudley's warmth. My feeling is that Beyond the Fringe would have been quite a cold, cerebral show without Dudley in it. You've got Jonathan Miller, you've got Alan Bennett, you've got Peter Cook, these brilliant, brilliant men. And yet Dudley was the twinkly elf, you know, the person that brought warmth and bonhomie and humanity into it. Was that how it seemed at the time?
Well, I think certainly, yes. I can understand what you're saying when I listen to you now. Looking at the other characters, I mean, they're so different, and their career paths were so different afterwards, which was probably true of a lot of the people at the establishment. There was such a diversion. Came together for one, what was it, 2 years, 3 years, something like that, really not very long. And then everybody went off in different directions and have a different view of, you know, what actually happened in that time.
There's in your article, Elizabeth, in the oldie, it's a very good description of Peter Cook. Then in his mid-20s, he was the star. It helped that he was absurdly handsome, tall and slender, with a mop of dark hair and bright, watchful eyes. Of the performers, Peter was the one throwing ad-libs and spanners in the works, scanning the audience, gauging responses. So he was really running the show, is that right? He was an extraordinary figure.
Yes, he would. And when there were rows in the audience, I think Siobhan McKenna, you know, and people would stand up and shout. It was always Peter who either took the heat out of it or responded to it. So there was a lot of comings and goings between the stage and the audience. And it was a small space, if you can imagine, and people were just right up against the stage. So if anybody wanted to jump up and swing at somebody, they could. And Peter was definitely, he was a pacifist. you know, he could defuse situations.
Well, there's a brilliant bit you talk about him, the Richardson brothers, the sort of like the craze turned up, and he managed to get them out of the club. How did he do that?
I don't know. I mean, there was a great kerfuffle on the back stairs, and a lot of shouting and going on, and then Peter's voice over the top of it, and he just talked them down. He sort of talked them down. He made jokes, of the kind of, you don't want to be here really, and we're all a bunch of whatever it was. And he got them out on the street. It was extraordinary. It was about three stairwells, as it were, that he talked them down.
And then it actually, for the establishment, which is so famous, it didn't last very long, despite being a huge success. Why was that? Why did it come to an end?
Well, I mean, it was Soho in the 60s. The amount of people who were wanting backhanders at the door, or half the stores went out of the back door as soon as they came in the front. So that was a problem. Nicholas started a rather magnificent magazine called Scene, which again didn't last very long, but employed Tom Stoppard as Henry Boot. He didn't have a job before then.
As a theatre critic, is that right?
As a theatre critic,
yeah. Pretty good, yeah.
Not bad. Oh, first, I think it had the first national, well, it would call itself a national, it sold quite a few copies, of Profile of the Beatles.
Again, pretty good, yeah.
It was pretty groundbreaking. There's a few copies stuck somewhere.
And to meet Peter Cook, was he intimidating because he was so brilliant? What was he like?
That, but also that you didn't quite know which way he would jump, and he had a sort of edge of danger which never left him. And I'm not quite sure where it came from, or whether it just women perceived it, or, you know, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was different with men, but certainly I would imagine you'd need a lot of courage to fall in love with Peter. And everybody was a little bit in love with Peter. Of course you were, except I was in love with Nicholas. So
right.
There you are.
And William, I saw Richard Ingham, as I said, the other day, and he said the obvious answer to it going wrong with Peter Cook was the booze, and he could tell when Peter had been drinking when he watched him on telly or in the theatre because his timing was off. But is that the simple answer why this great, great, great comic genius went wrong, as it were? Is the booze?
Well, I think so, yeah, in part. But I mean, I guess then when you unpick that, why was he drinking so much? So that's a conundrum that I guess nobody can really answer. Certainly the amount of work tailed off, the quality of the work tailed off, although there were flashes of brilliance. It certainly did for Peter's relationship with Dudley, that's for sure. I mean, there's no doubt about that at all.
When did they fall out?
Well, they fell out on this mammoth tour of America they did, doing this amazing...
When was that tour?
That was in the early to mid-70s.
Right.
And they were on the road altogether for about 4 years off and on. I mean, it was an enormous tour. It took them away from their families and their wives, obviously. They were doing it in the West End. It was called Behind the Fridge. And it's brilliant, brilliant, very dark. Funnily enough, they had an extremely dark sketch in it in which Dudley's getting picked up by a chauffeur played by Peter who, you know, becomes more and more clear is about to murder him. Hardly a laugh in it. Very gloomy. The producers wanted to cut this sketch, and Harold Pinter came to see it and said, "I love it, keep it in." I mean, it was Pinteresque, this show. They took it off to Australia. They then took it around the States, and Peter was drinking more and more, and he's very unhappy to be staying in this endless succession of hotels. And Dudley at the end said, "I've had enough, I'm going to stay in America and try and make it in Hollywood." Did nothing apart from practice the piano in his garage in LA for a couple of years, and then got this incredible break in Ten and Arthur, you know, which are the two landmark films. Ten in particular, I think, is an absolutely brilliant film.
And had they reconciled by the time Peter Cook died in 95, is that right?
Not really. I mean, you know, to a certain extent. I mean, but it's interesting talking to Rena and Brian about this, because obviously they knew Dudley in his last years. And I think the saddest thing of all for Peter and for fans of Peter is that they say, you know, Dudley didn't really talk about him very much. You know, he wasn't really that interested anymore. And I think Dudley had moved on and Peter hadn't. And Dudley was very cautious around Peter. I mean, I think the interesting thing about the comic relationship it was very sadomasochistic. And, you know, you can look at Laurel and Hardy, you can look at Morecambe and Wise, you can look at Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, you know, I mean, it's the classic partnership in that respect. And the sketches got crueler and crueler. And
always Peter bullying Dudley.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the end, Dudley gets the upper hand, and in a sense that ends the relationship. It's very interesting if you look at the films. In the sketches, on stage and on telly, Peter's the governor, Peter's the boss. But when they get in the movies, suddenly, bedazzled, bang, Dudley knows what he's doing and Peter's kind of floundering. And I think that relationship changed. And who's to say that the drinking wasn't part of that?
And Elizabeth, how long did you go on seeing both of them until they died?
Really Peter, because Peter was in London. So,
right.
You know, over in LA, it's a long way away.
Yeah.
But at Peter's memorial, certainly Dudley gave a very moving speech and played Goodbye on the piano at the end of
moving,
it.
Moving, yeah.
So it was, whatever the relationship at the end, it was certainly, you know, that Dudley came in at that point and everybody heard his speech and everybody listened to the Goodbye. So, I don't know.
And Peter, you kept on seeing right into the 90s,
yes.
And remained incredibly funny, good company?
Yes, he did. He was, he and Nicholas had a really good relationship and were always very pleased to see each other. But both of them had gone off on, you know, quite different directions, although we did coincide, often at sort of political gatherings, which was quite entertaining.
Oh, really? Like what sort of thing?
I remember one with Mrs. Thatcher when she got in, I think, the second time. There was a big party down in Chelsea Church Street. And there were masses of people and a lot of drinking and drugs and the usual things that sort of happen in situations like that. And Peter had red hair. It was rather surprising.
He had some great hairstyles.
He had red hair. Yes, yeah. And he was surrounded by a mass of people, very kind of enthusiastic about him, because he was always a star. He always drew people to him, where, you know, he could enter a room and everybody wanted to stand next to him. So he never lost that. Even when he drank. I think he did come in and out of the drinking.
Yeah.
There were times when he wasn't drinking, and then he went on. But a lot of his generation, my generation, the men, you know, lots of them have gone that way. It was the drug of choice.
Yeah, and in fact, I should have said, Elizabeth, as the latest book is My Life as a Wife, Love, Liquor, and What to Do About the Other Woman, which, without being too rude, a lot of it is about your late husband, Nick Luard, who, that was his drug of choice.
Yes, certainly it was. Yes, women, actually, not I think
right.
That didn't really...
Oh, other women, sorry, yeah. Other women.
What to do? I've still no idea what to do about the other women,
right.
So don't ask me.
And I just read something the other day. Spectator said that the real impact of the establishment was that it made comedy more establishment. Do you agree with that? Or actually, that's a clever line.
Just a clever line.
Yeah.
I think there's always that, you know, something is off left field and it becomes centre field and then everybody says, well, it always was centre field.
Right.
But that's not true.
Right. Wonderful. And Annabelle Sampson, our digital editor, is here. I don't know if she had any further questions you wanted to ask, Annabelle.
No, that was really interesting. I really enjoyed hearing all of that. It has been said that today's politicians are beyond satire. What do you think of that?
I think they could do with a good satirisation. Bring back the establishment.
Okay, well, William Cook and Elizabeth Luard, thank you so much for starring in the first Aldi podcast.
Thank you, Harry.
Thank you.
Thank you, William.